This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Ian Bartholomew. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Chapter 6, Part 12. May was now approaching, and that month had been fixed for the meeting of the Houses. But they were again prorogued to November. It was not strange that the King did not wish to meet them, for he had determined to adopt a policy which he knew to be in the highest degree odious to them. From his predecessors he had inherited two prerogatives, of which the limits had never been defined with strict accuracy, and which, if exerted without any limit, would of themselves have sufficed to overturn the whole polity of state and of the church. These were the dispensing power and the ecclesiastical supremacy. By means of the dispensing power, the King purposed to admit Roman Catholics, not merely to civil and military, but to spiritual offices. By means of the ecclesiastical supremacy, he hoped to make the Anglican clergy his instruments for the destruction of their own religion. This scheme developed itself by degrees. It was not thought safe to begin by granting the whole Roman Catholic body a dispensation from all statutes imposing penalties and tests, for nothing was more fully established than that such dispensation was illegal. The Cabal had, in 1672, put forth a general declaration of indulgence. The Commons, as soon as they met, had protested against it. Charles II had ordered it to be cancelled in his presence, and had, both by his own mouth and by a written message, assured the Houses that the step which had caused so much complaint should never be drawn into precedent. It would have been difficult to find in all the Inns of Court a barrister of reputation to argue in defence of a prerogative which the sovereign, seated on his throne in full Parliament, had solemnly renounced a few years before. But it was not quite so clear that the King might not, on special grounds, grant exemptions to individuals by name. The first object of James, therefore, was to obtain from the courts of common law an acknowledgement that, to this extent at least, he possessed the dispensing power. But, though his pretensions were moderate when compared with those which he put forth a few months later, he soon found that he had against him almost the whole sense of Westminster Hall. Four of the judges gave him to understand that they could not, on this occasion, serve his purpose. And it is remarkable that all the four were violent Tories, and that among them were men who had accompanied Jeffreys on the bloody circuit, and who had consented to the death of Cornish and of Elizabeth Gaunt. Jones, the Chief Justice of the Common Pleas, a man who had never before shrunk from any drudgery, however cruel or servile, now held in the royal closet language which might have become the lips of the purest magistrates in our history. He was plainly told that he must either give up his opinion or his place. "For my place," he answered, "I care little. I am old and worn out in the service of the crown. But I am mortified to find that your majesty thinks me capable of giving a judgment which none but an ignorant or a dishonest man could give." "I am determined," said the king, "to have 12 judges who will be all of my mind as to this matter." "Your majesty," answered Jones, "may find 12 judges of your mind, but hardly 12 lawyers." He was dismissed, together with Montague, Chief Baron of the Exchequer, and two puny judges, Neville and Charlton. One of the new judges was Christopher Milton, younger brother of the great poet. Of Christopher little is known except that, in the time of the Civil War, he had been a royalist, and that he now, in his old age, leaned towards popery. It does not appear that he was ever formally reconciled to the Church of Rome, but he certainly had scruples about communicating with the Church of England, and had therefore a strong interest in supporting the dispensing power. The King found his counsel as refractory as his judges. The first barrister who learned that he was expected to defend the dispensing power was the Solicitor General, Heneage Finch. He peremptorily refused and was turned out of office on the following day. The Attorney General, Sawyer, was ordered to draw warrants authorizing members of the Church of Rome to hold benefices belonging to the Church of England. Sawyer had been deeply concerned in some of the harshest and most unjustifiable prosecutions of the age, and the Whigs abhorred him as a man stained with the blood of Russell and Sidney. But on this occasion he showed no want of honesty or of resolution. "Sir," he said, "this is not merely to dispense with a statute. It is to annul the whole statute law from the accession of Elizabeth to this day. I dare not do it. And I implore your Majesty to consider whether such an attack upon the rights of the Church be in accordance with your late gracious promises." Sawyer would have been instantly dismissed, as Finch had been, if the government could have found a successor. But this was no easy matter. It was necessary for the protection of the rights of the Crown that one at least of the Crown lawyers should be a man of learning, ability, and experience. And no such man was willing to defend the dispensing power. The Attorney General was therefore permitted to retain his place during some months. Thomas Powis, an insignificant man, who had no qualification for high employment except civility, was appointed solicitor. The preliminary arrangements were now complete. There was a Solicitor General to argue for the dispensing power, and 12 judges to decide in favour of it. The question was therefore speedily brought to a hearing. Sir Edward Hales, a gentleman of Kent, had been converted to popery in the days when it was not safe for any man of note openly to declare himself a papist. He had kept his secret, and when questioned, had affirmed that he was a Protestant with a solemnity which did little credit to his principles. When James had ascended the throne, disguise was no longer necessary. Sir Edward publicly apostatized and was rewarded with the command of a regiment of foot. He had held his commission more than 3 months without taking the sacrament. He was therefore liable to a penalty of £500, which an informer might recover by action of debt. A menial servant was employed to bring a suit for this sum in the court of King's Bench. Sir Edward did not dispute the facts alleged against him, but pleaded that he had letters patent authorizing him to hold his commission notwithstanding the Test Act. The plaintiff demurred, that is to say, admitted Sir Edward's plea to be true in fact, but denied that it was a sufficient answer. Thus was raised a simple issue of law to be decided by a court. A barrister, who was notoriously a tool of the government, appeared for the mock plaintiff, and made some feeble objections to the defendant's plea. The new Solicitor General replied. The Attorney General took no part in the proceedings. Judgment was given by the Lord Chief Justice, Sir Edward Herbert. He announced that he had submitted the question to all the 12 judges, and that, in the opinion of 11 of them, the King might lawfully dispense with penal statutes in particular cases, and for special reasons of grave importance. The single dissident, Baron Street, was not removed from his place. He was a man of morals so bad that his own relations shrank from him, and that the Prince of Orange, at the time of the Revolution, was advised not to see him. The character of Street makes it impossible to believe that he would have been more scrupulous than his brethren. The character of James makes it impossible to believe that a refractory baron of the Exchequer would have been permitted to retain his post. There can be no reasonable doubt that the dissenting judge was, like the plaintiff and the plaintiff's counsel, acting collusively. It was important that there should be a great preponderance of authority in favour of the dispensing power, yet it was important that the bench, which had been carefully packed for the occasion, should appear to be independent. One judge, therefore, the least respectable of the 12, was permitted, or more probably commanded, to give his voice against the prerogative. The power which the courts of law had thus recognized was not suffered to lie idle. Within a month after the decision of the King's Bench had been pronounced, four Roman Catholic lords were sworn of the Privy Council. Two of these, Powis and Bellesley, were of the moderate party, and probably took their seats with reluctance and with many sad forebodings. The other two, Arundel and Dover, had no such misgivings. The dispensing power was, at the same time, employed for the purpose of enabling Roman Catholics to hold ecclesiastical preferment. The new solicitor readily drew the warrants in which Sawyer had refused to be concerned. One of these warrants was in favour of a wretch named Edward Sclater, who had two livings which he was determined to keep at all costs and through all changes. He administered the sacrament to his parishioners according to the rites of the Church of England on Palm Sunday, 1686. On Easter Sunday, only 7 days later, he was at Mass. The royal dispensation authorized him to retain the emoluments of his benefices. To the remonstrances of the patrons for whom he had received his preferment, he replied in terms of insolent defiance, and, while the Roman Catholic cause prospered, put forth an absurd treatise on the defense of his apostasy. But a very few weeks after the revolution, a great congregation assembled at St. Mary's in the Savoy to see him received again in the bosom of the church which he had deserted. He read his recantation with tears flowing from his eyes, and pronounced a bitter invective against the popish priests whose arts had seduced him. Scarcely less infamous was the conduct of Obadiah Walker. He was an aged priest of the Church of England, and was well known in the University of Oxford as a man of learning. He had in the late reign been suspected of leaning towards popery, but had outwardly conformed to the established religion, and had at length been chosen Master of University College. Soon after the accession of James, Walker determined to throw off the disguise which he had hitherto worn. He absented himself from the public worship of the Church of England, and with some fellows and undergraduates whom he had perverted, heard Mass daily in his own apartments. One of the first acts performed by the new Solicitor General was to draw up an instrument which authorized Walker and his proselytes to hold their benefices, notwithstanding their apostasy. Builders were immediately employed to turn two sets of rooms into an oratory. In a few weeks, the Roman Catholic rites were publicly performed in University College. A Jesuit was quartered there as chaplain. A press was established there under royal license for the printing of Roman Catholic tracts. During 2 years and a half, Walker continued to make war on Protestantism with all the rancor of a renegade. But when fortune turned, he showed that he wanted the courage of a martyr. He was brought to the bar of the House of Commons to answer for his conduct, and was base enough to protest that he had never changed his religion, that he had never cordially approved of the doctrines of the Church of Rome, and that he had never tried to bring any other person within the pale of that church. It was hardly worthwhile to violate the most sacred obligations of law and of plighted faith for the purpose of making such converts as these. In a short time the King went a step further. Sclater and Walker had only been permitted to keep, after they became Papists, the preferment which had been bestowed on them while they passed for Protestants. To confer a high office in the established church on an avowed enemy of that church was a far bolder violation of the laws and of the royal word. But no course was too bold for James. The deanery of Christ Church became vacant. That office was, both in dignity and in emolument, one of the highest in the University of Oxford. The dean was charged with the government of a greater number of youths of high connections and of great hopes than could then be found in any other college. He was also the head of a cathedral. In both characters, it was necessary that he should be a member of the Church of England. Nevertheless, John Maisie, who was notoriously a member of the Church of Rome, and who had not one single recommendation, except that he was a member of the Church of Rome, was appointed by virtue of the dispensing power, and soon within the walls of Christ Church an altar was decked, at which Mass was daily celebrated. To the nuncio, the King said that what had been done at Oxford should very soon be done at Cambridge. End of part 12.